Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to introduce my guest co-host, Dr. Catherine Koh.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
It's good to have you back. We're always sorry when Christy's out galvanizing around the world, saving lives, but we're really happy to have you.
Thank you. It's very fun to be here again.
You know, on our show today, we're actually going to also be talking with Dr. Richard Schwartzstein, professor of medicine and medical education at Harvard Medical School, about medical students in the 21st century, nature versus nurture. I know that you're excited about the conversation.
I'm very excited. We'll be discussing one of his recent articles in the New England Journal of Medicine, and really kind of near and dear to my heart, because I just went through this process of being selected for medical school.
Were you selected because of your nature or because of your nurture?
I like to think hopefully a little bit of both.
A little bit of both. Yeah. We know we've had experience. We know it's both. Well, speaking of experience, we first have some really interesting research that matters that we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the diagnosis of high cholesterol in Hispanic populations.
Yeah, and then we're also going to look at a study about a new test that could potentially detect head and neck cancers earlier than they otherwise present.
We'll talk about abuse of elders. How common is it?
And then a question, are too many young Americans getting antipsychotics for ADHD and other illnesses like depression?
We'll see what we both think. Let's talk about this first research that matters, which was an article that was in the Journal of the American Heart Association about the diagnosis of high cholesterol in Hispanics. Very interesting, and I thought, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it looks like they reviewed data from more than 16,000 Hispanics between the ages of 18 and 24 and found that about 44% of men and 40% of women had high cholesterol, higher than the general U.S. population. And then, interestingly, almost they didn't really know that they had that.
Yeah, you know, actually, it's the ages of 18 and 74.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but that a large number, 60% of these folks, you know, had high cholesterol, higher than perhaps the general population, and certainly higher that people weren't aware of that. And even of those who were aware of it didn't know, you know, that they needed to get treatment, which suggests that there's a large percentage of Hispanics in the United States that are really not getting treated. And they actually tried to tease it out. They found out that those who were less likely to have it controlled were those who were younger, women, those who didn't have insurance, those who had less income, and those who were more recently immigrated to the United States.
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of health education that we can look to doing specifically within the Hispanic population to try and make them more aware of either A, asking about cholesterol check, and then B, what resources are available for them for treatment.
And we might even have to educate ourselves and our colleagues that perhaps there's an implicit bias that we're bringing in here, that when our Hispanic patients come in, maybe we're not thinking the same way, because it's, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, not me. I'm sure I'm great. But no, maybe I'm not so good.
Right. Definitely. Definitely going to be a multi-pronged approach to try and fix that.
Speaking about new approaches, let's talk about this next research that matters. And this is an article about a potential new DNA test for head and neck cancer.
Yeah, so it looks at taking blood and saliva samples and then running this report on the DNA found in the saliva to see how at risk someone is of developing head and neck cancers early. So this was a report published in the June 24th Journal of Science and Translational Medicine. And interestingly, kind of looks at whether or not things like the human papillomavirus are found and make people more at risk for head and neck cancers.
Yeah. So the other risk factors other than this virus that can cause head and neck cancer are alcohol and tobacco, chewing tobacco.
Definitely.
And these are major risk factors that when people get head and neck cancer, and they get therapy, the question is, how well are they responding? And the researchers think that this potential new DNA test, because it may be shed by cancer tumors most of the time, could be very helpful to monitoring a response to therapy and seeing if you're cured, which would be a great non-invasive way of perhaps doing this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But the researchers do say that there's definitely more work that needs to be done for this, and it's not quite ready to be used in the clinical setting as a normal screening technique.
But I think this is we like this research because it's while it's not quite yet ready for prime time, it's coming there. And I know that for some of my patients with breast cancer now, the way they monitor therapy is they look at circulating breast cancer cells.
Right, yeah.
And so it's like, wow, this is a non-invasive, easy, early way to see, are mm-hmm. you responding to therapy? I think definitely. We're going to see more of this. We like it.
Definitely. So our next one is about elder abuse and how it actually may be more common than people think. This was a study in the Journal of American Geriatric Society that looked and found that elder abuse is actually a common and identifiable condition that can occur and costs hundreds of dollars in healthcare.
Yeah, probably tens of millions, yeah, if not billions. But you know, it's interesting because I was thinking about, you know, when have I discovered elder abuse? And I'm thinking, oh, well, I have seen this. I've seen this a lot more than many of the rare diseases we study in medical school, and thinking that we're going to be talking with an expert today about medical education and nature and nurture, there is this learning about that this can happen. And in this particular review, it was particularly common among adults who had dementia, and which suggests that they're not able to care for a lot of their own needs, and they're relying on, in this case, children or family members to care for them. And maybe those interests aren't always perfectly aligned, like what's best for mom, if indeed there are finances or other issues at stake. It's bad to think about, but it happens.
Yeah, and I think importantly, elder abuse can take many forms, whether it be taking advantage of them financially or physical abuse, all different forms.
Psychological abuse.
Psychological as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what they found is that the prevalence of this, how often it happens, ranges from 10% of older adults to almost half of those with dementia. And it's changed from like 2% in Ireland to 61% in Croatia, 14% in India, and 36% in China. Wow, these are major issues. And I think it needs to be on our kind of way of understanding. And also our listeners, if you have a family member that you're worried about, come talk to your doctor about it.
Definitely. And from a preventative standpoint, they say as patients are getting older, it's important to try and take steps to prevent this from happening while they're still lucid before progressing to the later stages of dementia.
Make sure you have a living will. Make sure you have a guardian. Make sure that guardian
is someone you trust.
Is someone you trust. That's right. And hopefully it is a child if you have one, or a really, really good friend. Let's talk about our very last research that matters, Catherine, which is the number of antipsychotic prescriptions for ADHD and depression.
Yep. So this new study found that they are actually very commonly used for these two diseases, but interestingly, aren't quite yet approved by the FDA to be used for them.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Psychiatry, aptly enough, and it really looked over time how often these antipsychotic use is occurring in the United States for youth and young adults, and it's happening quite a bit, and for reasons that aren't even approved, not for antipsychotic use, but for things like depression and ADHD. And a lot of the prescribing is occurring not by psychiatrists, but by presumably primary care physicians. I was like, uh-oh.
Right, definitely. Yes.
What do you think about that?
Well, so it's interesting. I guess there are a couple of clinical trials that suggest adding an antipsychotic like risperidone or the brand name Risperdal when used with stimulants can actually be effective in treating ADHD. But again, that question of whether or not that's within our realm to be able to do if it's not quite yet been fully studied and elucidated and approved by the FDA.
Yeah, I think that also perhaps some of the doctors are reticent to maybe write the diagnosis of psychosis or mm-hmm. other more serious things on a patient's record. But you know what? If you're giving an antipsychotic, I think that you should be really saying what you're giving it for. I think it's good medicine. I'm worried about this particularly.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a chance to talk about perhaps maybe too many young adults and youth are getting antipsychotics, particularly for the wrong reasons.
And then how elder abuse is actually more common than people think and how to kind of prevent it.
About being on the lookout for new tests for perhaps monitoring head and neck cancers.
And then how half of U.S. Hispanics with high cholesterol are unaware that they have it and steps to change that.
That'll conclude the Research Matter portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Richard Schweitzman, professor of medicine and medical education at Harvard Medical School, about medical students in the 21st century, nature versus nurture. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we're talking with Dr. Richard Schwartzstein, professor of medicine and medical education at Harvard Medical School, about medical students in the 21st century, nature versus nurture.
Welcome, Dr. Schwartzstein. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Catherine, for the invitation.
Of course. So this is something that I just recently finished, getting into medical school, finishing medical school. And so wondering if you could tell us a little about your journey to medicine and more specifically to medical education.
Sure. It's probably not so dissimilar to a lot of people. I originally in school thought I was going to be an engineer, was big into math and science. And I go back a few years, and this was the days of the astronauts and things like that. And fascinated me, and then I had an illness in my family. My father got very sick, was in the hospital, and I started to read about what was wrong with him, and suddenly I realized biological science was actually more interesting even than aeronautics might be. So that's sort of how I got transitioned over to medicine. And as I went through medical school and then residency program, we all teach as residents, and you think that's a great thing, and education was always very important for me growing up and for my family. But when I became a fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine and was doing some research, I was really exposed to some truly outstanding teachers that really sort of intrigued me in terms of using education as something that was more perhaps part of my career. Although it wasn't until I was on the faculty for about 10 years that I got a chance to really teach in the medical school in the physiology course. And 5 years after that, I became a course director, and then from there on, things really got more intense for me as a teacher. And I wound up doing a fellowship in medical education sort of halfway through my career, which also helped me learn more about the science of learning.
So let me ask you, Dr. Schwartzstein, you know, you're on this path from engineering and science to medical education. And, you know, ultimately, kind of coming full circle back to, well, are we bringing the right sorts of students into medical school? What caught your attention that perhaps we aren't on the right path or the path needs to be changed? When did you become aware, and was there something that happened?
Well, I've not been quite so concerned that they're not the right people, but I was involved in a process with the Association of American Medical Colleges to redo the MCAT exam, you know, the exam that all the students who want to go to med school have to take. And there was a lot of discussion on that committee about this issue of whether we were getting the right students and could we put something on the MCAT exam that actually would help us discern whether a student was sufficiently empathic or sufficiently humanistic or sufficiently geared towards others besides themselves as to whether or not they should, you know, be in med school. And we went into some really interesting conversations on that committee and looked at data about that and even tried to think about how one might make that determination. And it was really that got me kind of refocused on this question. And I will say that with all that interest in science and engineering, I majored in college in politics. So I always had a bent towards the non-science as well and felt like I had eclectic taste in many ways and had prided myself in some ways of being more well-rounded, in my interest and readings and that sort of thing. And to me, that has always helped me as a doctor, having both that social science and philosophy background that I had in addition to the traditional pre-medical courses.
Gotcha. So for those of our listeners who don't know, the MCAT is the Medical College Admission Test, and it's a test that all people who are applying to medical school have to take before they even can apply, really. And typically, it's very much hard math and science, really testing whether or not you have a good background for what medicine ultimately will teach you. But what you're telling us, Dr. Schwartzstein, is that that now you've incorporated an additional aspect to the MCAT. And can you describe that a little bit and what you're hoping to get out of it with the
MCAT? Well, so the MCAT exam it has been changed, and starting actually this year, the new exam will be coming out, and it includes social sciences, it includes behavioral sciences, as well as the more traditional chemistry, physical sciences, biological sciences. And the notion was that to be a physician in this era, in the 21st century, it takes more than just pure science, the traditional science concept, to be a physician. So, and then trying to figure out which of the sciences, sociology, psychology, economics, philosophy, you know, and so forth, these other areas that should be covered, you know, was challenging as well, because there are limits on how long that exam can be and how many courses a student might be expected to take in various areas for their pre-medical requirement. But there was certainly this very explicit push to say just doing physical, chemical, and biological sciences is not sufficient in order to become a physician. And so this new section does emphasize the behavioral and social sciences in ways that we did not have before.
So, you know, our listeners should know that Dr. Schwartzstein just published an essay in the New England Journal of Medicine called Getting the Right Medical Student's Nature Versus Nurture. And I want to pick up on a comment you made in your essay, which said, you know, when you come into the hospital and you have, let's say, needing to have surgery, you do want a compassionate physician, but you also really care about a competent physician. And so those are both important. How do you get the medical students to buy into that it's not just, though, about competency and compassion? It's this package, because it seems to me that given the choice between the person who's competent and the one who's compassionate, I'll take the competent one.
Well, the interesting thing is that in my experience, most medical students come in with that bent anyway, right? Because they don't really have the skills, obviously, to be a physician. But what they do have is a sense of, I want to help somebody. And when you look at why people go to medical school and the personal statements, the thing that drives them, it often is these days this sense of still wanting to help other people. There's a big bend towards global health. People are very interested in this, you know, as the world seems to get smaller and smaller, what's happening with disasters around the world and illnesses that break out, plagues and various things that are happening. And there's an innate sense for most medical students that they're in this business or want to go into this business because they really want to help people. And I think this issue then of nature versus nurture is what happens once they get into our hands in medical school and in their post-medical school training as specialists, where the what's often termed hidden curriculum, the things that they see other doctors doing that undermines their own personal beliefs and what we actually do try to teach them about humanism and about caring for other people.
Can you give us an example?
That becomes a problem.
Can you give us an example?
Well, you know, when you they get out on the wards and they'll see a physician who talks to a family or a patient using medical jargon and doesn't take the time to try to translate what's going on into terms that a patient or family can understand, or that tells somebody bad news without sitting down at the bedside and telling and showing in terms of their body language that they've got the time so that the patient can ask questions and that they're not being distracted by other activities. So there's many things that we certainly teach our students to do that will demonstrate empathy, that will create a partnership with the patient or the patient's family. And yet many of our doctors in the day-to-day, because they're hurried, they're stressed, they've got too many patients waiting to see them, don't do those things. And the student starts to say, well, I was taught one thing, but I'm now watching this doctor who's a great doctor, very well respected, national reputation, and they don't seem to be doing it. Maybe it's not necessary.
So it seems that changing the curriculum and really trying to show the students that you do need to be, at least take the time, as you're saying, to make that connection with the patient is definitely important. But it also seems as though there's a generation of physicians who have already been trained in other ways. How do we reach them to tell them to try and change the ways that they interact with patients as well in order to teach the future generation?
You can't just shake
physicians.
Them, can you?
Yeah, this is one of our challenges, the way we refer to it as faculty development. So, you know, one of my jobs is, in fact, working with faculty saying, you know, this is what you're actually doing and this is the way we need to do it and here are the reasons why. And we're trying to develop more of what we call peer observation programs where a teacher will watch another teacher, a colleague, doing their rounds, you know, where they're going to see various patients in the hospital, talking to that patient, you didn't use the right language, or you went into the room and you didn't pull the curtain so that the patient had privacy. And most of the time, I mean, most of our faculty, even if they're not always able to do it the right way, they want to do it the right way. And again, it's this distraction of the busyness of our schedules and so forth that prevents us from thinking about it. So we try to make people more aware in the moment of these things on a regular basis. And then if you do it, practice it that way enough, then it becomes part of your routine.
Well, speaking,
hopefully we can break that hidden curriculum.
Speaking of the business of the schedule, we're going to need to actually take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue having this conversation with Dr. Richard Schwartzstein, professor of medicine and medical education at Harvard Medical School, about medical students in the 21st century, nature versus nurture. And maybe we'll talk about some of your work in curricular reform and what's new and important. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We've been talking to Dr. Richard Schwartzstein, professor of medicine and medical education at Harvard Medical School, about medical students in the 21st century, nature versus nurture. And before the break, Dr. Schwartzstein, you alluded to how a busy clinical schedule can sometimes prevent practicing physicians from sharing empathy and teaching empathy to medical students and residents. And a quick question, given that I am still learning how to be a good doctor, and in a busy clinical schedule when I am so pressed for time, and does being a compassionate doctor make me kind of more or less efficient? And how do you balance those two in your learning?
Yeah, that's a great question, Catherine. And let me give you one example from the outpatient world, the ambulatory, and one from the inpatient side. You know, in the outpatient world, we're all being pressed these days that, you know, see every patient in 20 minutes, or some primary care doctors even less than that. And yet if a patient comes in and there's a bad diagnosis you have to discuss with them, or just some problem that they're having at home, something like that, it obviously takes more time. And you get behind schedule. And now, unfortunately, in our system, we're also being graded on patient satisfaction in the way that whether you're timely is part of your grade as a physician. And so the next patient may be upset because you're late, but you need to be able to apologize. And I often would tell my patients, when you need the extra time, you know that you're going to get it. So I apologize for being late, but the patient before you really needed extra time. And I would say the vast majority of my patients would understand that and would feel fine about that, although there were occasional people who just were angry because you were late and felt that you weren't valuing their time sufficiently. So it still can be difficult, although I think usually the apology and the explanation works well. On the inpatient side, I think there actually can be some efficiency. So if you think about, again, as a critical care doctor working in the intensive care unit, we'll go in and see a patient, and their family may be there with them, and we'll come out of the room, and the family will want additional information. Now, I could tell the family I can come back in a few hours and we'll discuss it, but they want to know now what's going on. I've just been in there to see their husband or wife or parent or whoever it might be, and I think it's much better for them for me to take the time then to tell them what's going on, what I think's happening, answer their questions, and make it clear that they have my attention, because it'll save time for me later in the day playing telephone tag or other things with them, trying to get back in touch with them. So I like to do those things in the moment because I think it's better for the families and better for the patients. But I think in the end there can be actually some efficiencies because you don't have to worry about trying to recontact them to have those conversations.
You know, doing today's work now, I love it. Let me ask you this question. You're at Harvard, and I know you're intimately involved in curricular issues. And here at the University of North Carolina, we just enacted in the last year probably one of the first major reforms of the curriculum here in the last 75 years. Tell us about what is innovative in curricular for medical students, and how's it playing out?
Adam, another great question. I think the biggest thing nationally that's going on right now is saying to students that we're going to put you in a clinical environment virtually the first week of medical school. So when I went to medical school in the late 70s, you know, we didn't see many patients until the third year of medical school. And so there's a tendency at that time, it was felt, that people got a little bit hardened. They got too distant from the concept that there's a human being that's behind all of this work and learning and training that you're getting. And so now we try to put our students at almost every medical school in the country, I think, into some kind of patient contact clinical environment really right from the get-go. So it helps to motivate them. It helps them to connect what they're learning in the classroom with the fact that there is a patient at the other end of all this. And it allows us to begin really teaching the humanistic, empathic, interpersonal communication skills really from day one in a meaningful way because it's at the bedside, it's with a patient. So I think this bridging of the clinical and basic sciences and the fact that the patient is ultimately the center of all this work that you're doing is made apparent from the first weeks of med school now. And that's a real big change and I think a very important one across the country.
So now allowing the patient to be more of the teacher for our next generation of students.
Yeah, that's a very good point as well. It's the patient is a teacher in some ways in an implicit way. And we actually have a program right now where we're using patients and families explicitly to teach our residents about how to have conversations with families in the intensive care unit. So that's also being done, I'm sure, at other places as well, where we're literally using patients to help us teach our next generation of doctors.
So what do you think this next generation of medical learners, medical students is going to look like? Are we at a place where we should continue to take medical students right out of undergraduate and college, or should we kind of demand that they get more life experience so that they come in wiser and perhaps better able to integrate this nature versus nurture discussion?
Well, Adam, it's a tricky question in the sense that it takes a long time to go through the training, particularly if you go into a specialty. But I'd say about half of the, somewhere between a third and half of the Harvard students take time between college and med school now anyway. So that's a very common thing. People do gap years or they take several years often in a different field and then, you know, come to medicine late or do it even when they graduated college. They just wanted time to do something different before they went to med school. Of course, we compare ourselves to Europe where students go really from high school into medical school. So we're already having students be a little bit later by going to college, a full 4 years of college before they go to med school. So I don't think it's critical that people do extra time first, although we all mature at different rates, and for some people that's probably a good idea. Life experiences help, and of course, again, depending on your background, you may have a lot of those life experiences just as part of the routine of growing up and going through high school and college. So I don't think there's a one size that fits all, but I think this notion of having some kind of life experience, getting opportunities to interact with people outside your own family and friends, your intimate world, is an important part of preparing you to be a doctor.
So based on your expertise in this area, what makes a better physician ultimately? And I'm sure there's bits of both, but would it be the nature or the nurture side of things?
I think that we have people by their nature who most people could be doctors in a sense. There's not just the humanistic elements, but there's the curiosity. And we have problems now sometimes where we feel like our students are not sufficiently curious in an intellectual way. And I think that's the problem of the education system again. I don't think that children grow up curious. They naturally grow up curious. What do we do to them that gets rid of that? And I would say the same thing largely about these humanistic elements. We are social animals. We want to do well with others around us. We have that by our nature. And so I think the real key is to encourage that in people who want to be doctors and make sure that we don't beat it out of them in a sense, that we don't discourage it or give them messages that somehow this is not important, or provide a medical environment that says you have too many patients to see at too rapid a pace, that you're under so much stress that you can't operate in a sense on a day-to-day basis with the way that you would like to do if you only had time. And I think that's the real challenge right now, both in terms of the training that we do as well as the actual practice of medicine. If we don't do something about the pace of care and the stresses that the individual practitioner is under, then we're likely to continue to have these problems.
So if you were coming down and you were following our learners and our doctors, what would be your advice to them as you're kind of shadowing them, whispering in their ear as they're following 40 minutes behind and they're stressed, but they're doing the best they can, and then they have good nature and nurture? What would you whisper in their ear?
What I would tell them is to remind themselves that this is an incredible privilege to be a doctor, to be able to be in a position to get into the most intimate details with your patients in an effort to help them live with their diseases better, in some cases cure them, but most of what we do in medicine is helping people live better lives with chronic illnesses. And these crises they deal with are just incredible, and it's our job to help them through this, and that's a real privilege. And if we can remind ourselves of that periodically, at least for me, it always makes getting through that busy day a little bit easier.
Well, it's a real privilege talking with you and hearing and reading your work in the New England Journal of Medicine and sharing your experiences with your health listeners, Dr. Schwartzstein.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you again for the opportunity, and I hope that this has been helpful.
We've been talking with Dr. Richard Schwartzstein, professor of medicine and medical education at Harvard Medical School, about medical students in the 21st century, nature versus nurture. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. But first, I just want to acknowledge that we actually have a new executive producer today, Daniel Lane. Welcome to Your Health, Daniel.
It's great to be here.
You know, and we also want to just wish our executive producer for the last 2 years, Erica Norrie, well. She is really moved on to some really exciting things for her, but has been a constant voice on Your Health, and I'm sure people are really used to listening to her voice. Daniel, they'll hear your voice reading as well, but we wish Erica really well. And we'll listen to our very first house call today about a young patient who was depressed and perhaps hopeless, but something good happened.
I recently saw my family doctor because I was so depressed that I felt almost hopeless. I had severe back pain, I was unemployed, and I had an abusive partner. In just one visit, my family doctor helped me get an appointment with a therapist, started me on an antidepressant, and reassured me that I am a good person. And sure enough, things are a little better. I just wanted to say thank you.
Wow, what an impactful statement, and something that us as family physicians really like to hear, that we've actually made an impact and helped someone.
Yeah, this is kind of like that nature versus nurture discussion we were having today.
Right.
Certainly there was some real nature there where the doctor needed to diagnose the depression,
right,
though it doesn't sound like that was too hard,
yeah,
but you know, not always easy, and get the patient to a therapist and pick an antidepressant. Those were all the nature things. What about the nurture things?
Well, so the nurture things, it looks like this doctor did a lot of things in one visit and really tried to support the patient as best that they could, undoubtedly taking more than their 20-minute time slot.
I would think so.
But it definitely shows that, you know, taking that extra time with one patient who is needing it at that time really goes a long way.
Yeah, and I think I like this idea that things may get better. You know, you don't know that things are going to get better, but I think part of it is the belief. If you really believe it and you can encourage that, then sometimes it does, and tomorrow may be a little bit better. And, you know, we all have good days and bad days, and if we're having a bad day, maybe tomorrow will be a better day.
I think it's also important to highlight that if you are feeling hopeless, it is important to get in to see your doctor, because there are things available that we can do to try and help you.
Yep. Excellent point, Catherine. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 60-year-old woman on dialysis and have had both heart and diabetes problems. My doctor suggested considering a renal transplant, which I had never considered before. 1 year later, I'm on the transplant list. Do most doctors think like this?
Well, I think you should just keep that doctor who did, because, boy, that sounds like it's the right thing for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's important to highlight that it's very patient-specific as to what we think with regards to coming up with a plan for the best course of treatment for a patient. And so I would hope that in your situation, most doctors would think like that.
You know, I realize that because transplants are becoming more frequent, that perhaps I need to think about it more frequently because, for instance, I have a patient in their 70s who might need a liver transplant. And the question is, oh, the first instinct is, oh, they're too old to get a liver transplant. But then I went and looked at the literature, and it turns out that liver transplants are happening on older people. Just like 10, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have thought about doing bypass surgery on someone in their 90s, but now that's happening too. So age isn't itself. It really depends on how well they are.
Right, definitely. And I think it's important to look at kind of the new research and really push your doctor to think about the best course of action for you.
You know, this is a complicated issue though, but I often think it doesn't hurt sometimes to get a consultation. Mm-hmm. So in this particular case, I don't expect my colleagues or a lot of times even myself to really know whether or not this patient would qualify for a transplant. I mean, if they had cancer, they probably wouldn't and may depend on the reason why they are on dialysis, probably due to the heart hypertension and diabetes. But, you know, they could qualify and doesn't hurt to ask, could I have a visit with the specialist and see what they think? I think that's sometimes good medicine.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I'm 45 years old, and I have had high blood pressure for the past 5 years. My doctor treated the high blood pressure with a diuretic. Recent work showed that I had an elevated calcium level. 3 months and $600 later, the doctor says it was probably the diuretic that caused it. Shouldn't I have been informed this was possible before I started the medicine?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you go first on this one, Catherine.
I'm processing all of these things, and I'm thinking, what would I do if I saw an abnormal lab value? I think, first of all, I think they do make a good point that it is important to ask your doctor about risks when starting a new medicine. But there are so many side effects of all the medicines, it's impossible to list all of them.
You know, for a diuretic, I say, as well as for most medicines, I say, you know, there's about 100 side effects. Let me tell you about the top three or four. And for a diuretic, I would have said impotence. Number two, impotence. Number three, impotence. I would mention all those for, you know, particularly for my male patients.
Increased urinary frequency, perhaps?
Yeah, maybe a slight elevation in your blood lipids or blood sugar. But even though I'm taught that a high calcium can happen, that's not one that I would typically think about or I probably wouldn't tell the patient about. So I don't know if we could have prevented it.
Right.
But could we have diagnosed it without the $600 workup? Maybe. Maybe so because, you know, that is one of the causes and you look for causes that you could – see are obvious before you go searching for unobvious ones.
Right, but then you also wonder if they were trying to rule out more serious things that could have caused that elevated calcium. And was that something that they came to, that it was the diuretic only after making sure it wasn't anything more serious?
Right. You know, it's so much easier after we've made a diagnosis to say what we could have done better.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
But in this particular case, they made the diagnosis. They, you know, kept you safe, and so we should give some credit where credit is due. Mm-hmm. We're sorry that it cost you a lot of money. We hope you get better.
Yep.
Daniel, what's our very last house call?
I have had shoulder pain for 2 years. I saw a specialist who said it was likely a pinched nerve and offered to treat it with an injection. I asked if he needed to do an X-ray to be sure, but he said the results would not change how he treated me. The shot did help, but I'm still wondering about the X-ray. What do you think?
Well, again, this is a second-guessing here that we're, you know— Would I have done an injection without an X-ray? I don't know. Not usually, but I wouldn't say it's absolute.
Yeah, I think it depends on what symptoms the shoulder pain was coming in looking like. Was there any trauma beforehand to suggest that there maybe is like a broken bone that you need to look at? But a lot of times in these kind of chronic pains, you're looking for arthritis, and in which case maybe a steroid shot is going to be the treatment of choice in any case. And so trying to save some money, doing some cost-conscious care perhaps by avoiding a test that maybe the doctor thought was unnecessary at that time.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where you see arthritis one time and you see it like 100 times, but not everything that presents with shoulder pain and pinched nerve is arthritis. And it's, you know, you could have a ruptured tendon or perhaps the injection could cause a ruptured tendon. There are side effects of the injection. You don't know that beforehand.
Right.
You know, should the doctor have done it? I don't know. Are you better? Yes, we're getting – this is a good outcome here. Yeah. And I guess we're probably a little loath to second guess here.
Definitely.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls today. And we want to thank you all for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. And if you have questions or stories you want to share with us, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or get our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. And I'd like to thank you for having me here again today, Dr. Adam Goldstein.
It's great having you here, Catherine.
Yeah, and we'd also like to thank our guest today, Dr. Richard Swartstein. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.